A Story Publishing presents Oxford, From Mist to Modern. Mist still clings to the Isis as the year 1096 opens its eyes. On the riverbank stands a boyish clerk named Elfric, the crown of his head shaved in the clerical tonsure that marks him as both novice monk and would-be scholar. He fingers a scrap of vellum borrowed from the parish priest, rehearsing the declensions of Latin nouns. A wooden ferry creaks to the opposite shore, hooves drum on the timber bridge, and a stone tower rings prime. Nothing here resembles a university, only a knot of eager minds huddled in the nave of St. George's to parse a line of grammar before the daylight fades. Yet each uncertain footfall in the mud sets the first print in a trail that will stretch an entire millennium. Across the channel, King Henry II is not thinking of Elfric as he drafts an edict 50 years later. Paris, whose cathedral schools outshine any in England, has become a nest of political intrigue, so the king forbids his English clerks to study there. The decree is meant to box in a rival monarch, but its language drifts north and south on clerical gossip until it reaches the damp dormers of Oxford. Masters displaced from the Seine wander into the marketplace, find cheap lodging above alehouses, and turn the town's makeshift halls, long rooms with a single hearth, into classrooms. Henry never meets the boys who memorize Aristotle beside braying donkeys, yet his inked order supplies the accidental catalyst. Oxford acquires both teachers and the chip on its shoulder that comes from being anyone's second choice. By 1264, when Walter de Merton paces the cloisters of his Surrey estate, what began as improvisation teeters on chaos. Students drift like smoke between landlords, fistfights with townsmen spill into court rolls, hunger drives promising clerks back to the plow. Merton has served as Lord Chancellor. He speaks the language of parchment, seal, and silver. He drafts a charter that for the first time welds property, governance, and study into a single legal person, a college. His statutes require common meals, shared books, and audited accounts, distinctly unromantic details that anchor lofty talk to timber and stone. Copyists in London duplicate the rules. Within a generation, other benefactors imitate them. Where Elfric once squatted on a church bench, a network of endowed halls now grow like buttresses around a new idea. Knowledge deserves its own architecture. Two centuries later, the scent of ink replaces the smell of wet wool. In 1478, Theodoric Rude, a German printer lured by rumors of hungry readers and chantry money, locks the form of his wooden press near St. Mary's. When he pulls the bar, lead type, kisses paper, and 300 copies of Rufinus's Exposition of the Apostles' Creed appear in less time than one scribe would need to sharpen a quill. Scholars who once traveled days to borrow a single volume may now buy their own text for the price of a pair of shoes. Oxford's memory, until now entrusted to human voices and fragile parchment, gains a mechanical ally. With every sheet the press flattens, it also widens the gate through which disputation, heresy, and experiment can enter unchecked. Fast forward again, this time to a laboratory that hums with negative air pressure and LED task lights. It is January 2020. Professor Sarah Gilbert scans a gene sequence uploaded from Wuhan and recognizes the architecture of a threat. Within 48 hours, her team sketches a vaccine blueprint based on an adenoviral vector they have cultivated for years in relative obscurity. The design will travel from screen to syringe in 11 months, an interval that once separated medieval plague waves. The corridors outside still echo with Latin grace at dinner, and the muffled toll of Tom Tower. But pipettes in Gilbert's gloved hands confirm that Oxford's quarrelsome intellect has not been confined to antique quadrangles. Five figures, five moments, one question threads them together like a binding cord through choirs. How did a fog-wetted market town turn improvisation into endurance, and endurance into a laboratory capable of answering a global summons? The terrain is anything but straightforward. Rivers silt up, charters fight riots, parchment yields to movable type, steam to silicon. Yet in each upheaval, the university discovers that fragility can be a form of momentum. A banished clerk, a murdered landlord, a shattered orthodoxy, even a microscopic virus pushed the institution to reinvent itself while pretending with a wink that tradition never blinked. Tonight the reader stands where Elfrick once stood, between the smoke of cook fires and the bell that calls to prayer and argument alike. The river slides on, indifferent yet faithful, mirroring torches, gas lamps, streetlights, and now the glow of phone screens held up against the drizzle. A single hush settles, the heartbeat before a disputation begins. In that pause lies the promise of the pages ahead, to follow the uncertain, exhilarating path from riverbank to research powerhouse, and to decide what part of the story still waits to be written. End of prologue. From Rivers to Halls, Oxford's 11th Century Origins. Listen for a moment. It is just after daybreak on a mist-laden morning in the year 1096. You are standing on the reed-edged bank of the River Isis, the medieval name for the Thames as it threads through an unassuming market town called Oxford. The air smells of damp wool and wood smoke. A cock crows, hooves rattle over a timber bridge, bells in the small tower of St. George's Castle strike the hour, their bronze voices shimmering across low roofs. In the nave of a parish church only paces from the water, a handful of young men slide onto rough benches, ink-stained tablets in hand, ready to parse a line of Priscian's grammar by the light of rush tapers. This is not yet a university. The Latin universitas, meaning a corporate body with legal personality, will not be applied here for decades. Even so, a parchment memorandum, today in Lincoln Cathedral's archive, mentions Clerisi Oxoni, the clerks of Oxford, gathering for study in 1096. It is the earliest documentary crumb that lets historians place organized teaching in this town before the 12th century has turned its first corner. A scholar in Norman England was almost always a cleric. Tonsured and lettered, he hoped for preferment in chancery, cathedral, or monastery. He might be 13 or 33, and owned perhaps two books, most likely borrowed. To read theology or canon law meant literally reading aloud to a circle of listeners, then disputing meanings according to rules of dialectic honed in Bologna and Paris. Oxford, poised where a north-south road crossed an east-west river route, made logistical sense. Carts of Cotswold wool and barrels of saltfish already met here. Adding parchment and inquisitive minds cost little extra. Lodging, however, was improvisation itself. With no endowed colleges, students rented attic rooms above alehouses or slept in church porches. Hall in 1096 meant exactly what it did for a cattle drover, a long room with a hearth, hired by the week. Contrast Canterbury. In Christchurch Priory, the Benedictines copied Augustine and Gregory in an ordered scriptorium. Desks aligned, silence enforced. Oxford possessed no central library, and certainly no scriptorium. Masters taught from whatever texts they could beg or borrow, and one chronicler noted ruefully that pages often traveled farther than the bindings that were supposed to hold them. Yet scraps survive. The Bodleian today preserves an 11th-century glossed Gospel of Matthew, bearing the note, bought at Oxenford for 2 shillings from a Lombard. A manuscript of Gratian's Decretum shows 12th-century ownership marks tied to St. Frideswyde's Priory. Theology and canon law dominated because church courts were among the few institutions willing to pay for literacy. No royal charter buttressed these studies. Authority derived from the Bishop of Lincoln, in whose vast diocese Oxford lay, and from the goodwill of the town reeve who collected market tolls. Then, in 1167, King Henry II forbade English clerks to attend the schools of Paris. His pressure tactic against Louis VII unintentionally redirected a stream of displaced masters toward Oxford's vacant lofts and parish pulpits. Local burgesses saw opportunity, rents rose, the first scholar-townsman friction began to simmer. Paris had lecture halls and cathedral libraries. Oxford offered damp rooms and a master competing with braying market donkeys outside St. Mary the Virgin. Still, momentum gathered. By 1180, ecclesiastical testimony describes Oxford as a studium generale, open to any qualified Latinist. A clerk named Herbert of Bosham cross-examined in 1187, boasted that he had attended the disputations of Oxford and of no mean teachers there. Clearly a collective identity, if still fluid, was taking shape. Around the same moment, the rented long room began to harden into a proto-institution. Masters such as Robert Pullen and Edmund of Abingdon leased houses large enough to board their pupils, feed them at a common table, and enforce a rudimentary timetable. The pattern was ad hoc, yet it foreshadowed the college system. Perspective helps. Oxford in 1066 counted perhaps 1,000 residents. By 1200, maybe 2,000, of whom 100 were scholars. Hardly a metropolis, but enough that 1 in 6 adult males might be chasing footnotes by candlelight. Scholastic debate spilled noisily into the lanes, setting the stage for conflict. Before we move on, pin down 3 medieval terms that recur in our story. Scholar, a cleric studying the liberal arts, theology, or law, usually in minor orders. Clerk, near synonym, emphasizing ordained status and skill in Latin charters. Hall, a private lodging where a master offered beds, meals, and lessons. Some would evolve into colleges, most vanished with fashions or funds. Compare again our 2 learning centers. Canterbury prized continuity. Oxford thrived on argument. That difference, scriptorium order versus hall improvisation, will prove decisive in shaping English higher education. The Isis sheds its morning mist. Vendors hawk pies outside the castle gate. Scholars disperse to hire boats or haggle for parchment. They do not know they stand at the threshold of the oldest university in the English-speaking world. Conflict and charter, riot and reform, lie just beyond the bend in the road. Conflict, collegiate birth, and the Cambridge Schism. Picture Cornmarket Street in 1208. Pack horses jostle past trestles stacked with eels. Anxious scholars hurry between rented halls. 2 worlds have grown side by side, but not together. A single tragedy turns tension into rupture. 1 winter evening, 2 students quarrel with their landlord. A blow is struck. The townsman dies. The sheriff demands the culprits. When masters hesitate, the mayor seizes 3 random clerks and, without ecclesiastical trial, hangs them. Clerical immunity was customary law. The gallows shattered it. Terrified, some 300 masters and students leave overnight. Many drift home, but a large group takes the Roman road east to a fenland settlement called Cambridge. By 1231, Henry III refers to the scholars at Canterbridge in royal letters. Oxford's loss becomes England's 2nd university. The crisis forces Oxford to reconsider its governance. 3 benefactors supply the turning points. First, William of Durham's 1249 legacy endows rents on Cornmarket Street to feed 10 theologians. His great hall grows into University College. Next, John de Balliol and, after his death, his widow Dervergilla established statutes supporting 16 poor scholars. Balliol College adds structured charity. Finally, in 1264, Walter de Merton drafts rules that survive royal confirmation. His statutes forbid benefice pluralism, require annual accounts, and crucially, create a corporate body able to sue and be sued. Merton's template will echo across Europe. Economic stakes rise with endowment. Resentments multiply. Exempt from tolls, scholars dent borough revenue. Hostels boom while crafts stall. On St. Scholastica's Day, 10th of February 1355, a quarrel over sub-good wine in the Swindlestock Tavern ignites 2 days of violence. When royal commissioners tally the dead, about 30 scholars and 6 townspeople, King Edward III fines the town £200, forces annual penance with 63 wax candles, and grants the chancellor sweeping jurisdiction over grain, bread, and ale within 1 mile of Carfax. Authority has tilted decisively toward the university, now some 1,500 scholars strong. By 1400, corporate endowment has replaced personal patronage. Academic immunity, not clerical tonsure, guards students. Royal arbitration has become predictable leverage. Oxford's instinct for self-rule is set, just as metal type sails in from Mainz, to multiply statutes and sermons faster than any scribe. Presses, pulpits, and paradigm shifts. Oxford in the Renaissance and Reformation. In 1478, near St. Mary's Churchyard, Theodoric Rood pulls an oak bar and lifts freshly printed Latin text from his press. Surviving fragments suggest his first Oxford run, Rufinus on the Apostles' Creed, totaled about 300 copies. If each save described 12 hours, one job released 3,600 scholar hours. Between 1478 and 1500, presses in Oxford, Cambridge, and Westminster will issue at least 130 titles, driving book prices down by as much as 80%, and transforming institutional memory. Erasmus visits in 1499, polishing Greek with John Colet and lamenting that England trails Venice in output, yet he senses possibilities. Two generations later, those possibilities reshape doctrine. Henry VIII's break with Rome in 1534 and Mary I's bloody reaction, 1553-1558, turn Oxford into a stage of persecution. Latimer, Ridley, and Cranmer burn on what is now Broad Street. Fox's Acts and Monuments, 1563, fixes their martyrdom in Protestant memory, proof that print can amplify as well as inform. Meanwhile, new ideas slip between the covers. A copy of Copernicus's De Revolutionibus reaches Magdalen College by 1541, unsettling lectures that had rested on Aristotle for centuries. No one is dragged before the Inquisition in Oxford, but marginalia reveal vigorous debate, evidence that print has widened the syllabus and quickened dissent. The Reformation scrambles finance. Dissolved monasteries close one revenue stream, even as mercantile donors open new ones. Into this flux steps Sir Thomas Bodley. In 1602, he reopens Duke Humphrey's medieval library with 2,500 volumes and a novel idea, an agreement with the Stationers, company that funnels one copy of every London imprint straight to Oxford. Annual intake soon tops 400 volumes, quadrupling pre-agreement growth. A supply chain linking press to lectern to shelf is born. By 1620, Oxford hosts four permanent presses and Regis chairs in Greek, Hebrew, and medicine. Citation becomes routine, reproducibility a new scholarly virtue. Riot and charter forge the colleges. Now print rewires their circuits for the scientific age about to dawn. Reform to research powerhouse, Steam Age Oxford, June 1844. A broad-gauge locomotive exhales coal dust at the new station. London is 2 hours away, but many syllabuses still smell of 1744. Latin, Greek, divinity, a hint of mathematics. The Royal Commission of 1852 calls Oxford a nursery of idle gentlemen, prompting the Oxford University Act, 1854. Fellowships open to merit, celibacy rules vanish, resident dons gain a governing congregation, new faculties in natural science, law, and modern history appear. Numbers climb, roughly 1,500 students in 1850, 2,100 by 1870, just over 3,000 by 1900, 1 in 5 reading a science option. Railways funnel provincial talent. Town scholarships widen the accent range in Hall. On Parks Road, a glass and iron cathedral rises. The University Museum of Natural History, opened 1860. It hosts the celebrated Darwin-Wilberforce Exchange, Huxley's sharp retort drawing cheers, but the deeper victory is methodological, evidence marshaled in public. 5 years later, the Clarendon Laboratory opens Britain's first building purpose-designed for physics. Robert Clifton trains John Townsend, whose ionization studies will underpin 20th-century particle physics. Instruments, not voices, become the sound of discovery. Women enter next. Lady Margaret Hall admits 9 students in 1878. Somerville follows in 1879. Women sit exams from 1884 and receive full degrees in 1920. Bicycles with flying skirts become part of the high street traffic and foreshadow the workforce of 2 world wars. Telegraph wires lace the railway. Graduates correspond with Göttingen and Harvard. Oxford no longer ends at Carfax. It radiates along cables and rails, ready for the global challenges of the 20th century. Part 5. Innovation amid tradition. Oxford in the 20th and 21st centuries. May 1946. RAF lorries still idle beside Somerville, yet the examination schools already host demobbed servicemen in makeshift gowns. student numbers climb from 5,600 in 1938 to more than 24,000 today, almost half postgraduate and over 40% international. Governance reforms in 2000 create four academic divisions with budgets rivaling a mid-sized nation's science ministry. Annual external research income now tops £700 million. Oxford's Nobel roll passes 70. Dorothy Hodgkin maps insulin at Somerville. Anthony Hewish's radio astronomy of pulsars begins on a temporary array outside the city. John Gurdon pioneers nuclear reprogramming. Christopher Pissarides refines labor market theory over cappuccino opposite the Ashmolean. Curiosity thrives in cloisters and cafes alike. For centuries, the university taught merchants' sons, but not commerce itself. That changes in 1996 when Syrian-born businessman Wafik Saeed donates £70 million for a business school. Dixon Jones's low ochre brick design opens in 2001 beside remnants of medieval Rewley Abbey. Today, Saeed Business School's MBA ranks consistently in the global top 20, and its accelerators have spawned companies worth over £25 billion. The COVID-19 crisis reveals another facet. On the 10th of January 2020, Chinese scientists released the SARS-CoV-2 genome. 10 days later, Sarah Gilbert's team at the Jenner Institute designs a vaccine using the ChAdOx1 vector. Phase 1 trials begin in April. By December 2020, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine secures emergency approval. 2 years on, more than 2.5 billion doses have reached 180 countries, an 11-month sprint built on 15 years of quiet adenoviral research. Oxford University Innovation, founded 1987, now counts more than 300 active spin-outs. The Bodleian ingests 180,000 printed items and 15 terabytes of digital material each year. Solar panels crown college roofs, medieval masons never imagined, part of a plan for net zero operations by 2035. Stand at dusk where Walton Street meets the canal. Steam age brick, Cold War concrete, and startup glass share one skyline. Part 6, Colleges, Libraries, and Museums, a walking guide. Begin at the Martyrs Memorial on St. Giles, 10 minutes east of the station. Southward stretches Broad Street, the Ashmolean Museum's columned facade, free, Tuesday-Sunday, then the Sheldonian Theater, Christopher Wren's domed debut. A few steps east, the Weston Library welcomes all with its daylit atrium cafe. Slip through the gate marked Schole to the old school's quadrangle and the fan-vaulted Divinity School, England's oldest purpose-built university hall. Next door, guided tours lead into Duke Humphrey's Reading Room, its 15th-century oak still faintly scented by centuries of lamp oil. Outside, the Radcliffe Camera's Palladian drum dominates Radcliffe Square. All Souls' twin towers frame a sundial precise to the minute. Wander Queen's Lane to Hertford's Bridge of Sighs, then pivot south to St. Mary the Virgin, cradle of early lectures and host of Cranmer's trial. Farther east, Magdalen College's tower watches over Addison's Walk, where C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien debated myth and theology. Across the high sits the Botanic Garden, Britain's oldest, its wrought iron gate, bearing the rival emblems of Crown and Commonwealth. End at Christ Church Meadow, as longhorn cattle graze under Wren's Tom Tower. 101 bell strokes still mark Oxford's ancient curfew at 9:05 p.m. Optional detours lead north to the iron and glass vault of the Museum of Natural History and the eclectic Pitt Rivers beyond, where 600,000 artifacts cluster by theme, not geography. Every stop is within 2 kilometers. Listeners can pause playback, step inside, and resume the trail at will. Part 7, Bridges, Bicycles, and Beyond, Navigating the City of Oxford. Oxford is 7 kilometers end-to-end. Trains from London reach it in under an hour, coaches in 90 minutes. City buses accept contactless cards, e-bikes unlock by app. Average July highs hover around 23 degrees Celsius, January lows around 2 degrees Celsius. Pack an umbrella for quick showers. The 18th century covered market offers Oxford sausages and Ethiopian roast. Saturday's East Oxford Farmers Market keeps produce within a 30-mile radius. Punts launch from Magdalen Bridge March to October. Steer north along the Cherwell for quiet backwaters, south for meadow views and the little scene flank of Tom Tower. For a pint with provenance, try the Bear Inn, adorned with regimental neckties since 1242, or the Turf Tavern, hidden down a narrow passage where Bill Clinton once didn't inhale. Cyclists already make a quarter of city trips. New curb-protected lanes aim to let a 12-year-old ride from the station to the science labs unaided. Seasonal markers punctuate the year. At dawn on the 1st May, 10,000 people gather beneath Magdalen Tower to hear the choir sing the Hymnus Eucharisticus, a tradition unbroken since the 16th century. In September, the streets flare with St. Giles Fair, a carnival whose medieval hiring booths have given way to neon rides. Day trips unfold in every direction. Blenheim Palace by bus, Witham Woods on foot with a free permit, Abingdon Lock by cycle along the Thames Path. If rain forces shelter, Blackwell Hall's marble benches, Modern Art Oxford's free exhibits, or the Story Museum's Whispering Wood will keep curiosity dry. Pause on Magdalen Bridge at sunset. East, the Cherwell slides under willow shadows. West, the high funnels toward Carfax's Norman Stone. You can pick out almost every era we have traveled. St. George's Tower from the Conquest, the Radcliffe Camera's Enlightenment Dome, Side Business School's glass drum reflecting LED bike lights. Each century layered itself without erasing the one before. Late trains run till 23:30. The last London coach leaves just before 2. Return hired bikes to assigned bay. If you punt it after dark, hand the pole to the night porter rather than dive. Take with you the scent of old oak and roasting coffee, the knock of a punt pole on riverbed, the echo of Latin declensions bouncing off fan vaults. They are fragments of a thousand-year conversation still in progress, one you have joined simply by listening, walking, and wondering. Safe journey home. When the next question comes about manuscripts, microscopes, or the contents of that uncharted alley, remember that Oxford will still be here, equal parts memory and possibility, ready to answer. Thank you for choosing Astry Publishing.